Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
As is the Incomparable's Thanksgiving tradition, we gather around this table to celebrate the wonderful thankfulness that we have for the world of popular entertainment, and serving on the platter today is a nice, well-roasted duck. It's not brain science, it's rocket surgery for Thanksgiving. This is Howard the Duck.
This is a turducken for sure, Jason.
The Incomparable, number 691, November 2023.
Welcome back to The Incomparable, everybody. We're doing a Thanksgiving special, Rocket Surgery, where we talk about the excellent, legendary 1986 film from Lucasfilm, produced by George Lucas, of Star Wars fame. It's Howard the Duck, a famous flop from the 80s, a very 80s famous flop. And the story here is that we were doing our Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom episode, and we talked about how Willard Huck and Gloria Kurtz, and Gloria Katz were the writers of that. Well, they were also, I was like, oh, well, but also the writers of Howard the Duck. And suddenly, we all sort of said, Thanksgiving, rocket surgery, Howard the Duck, be there. And we're here.
Here we are.
So let me introduce my panel, including four co-conspirators who decided this was a good idea with me. Let me introduce them first. Annette Weirstra, unindicted co-conspirator number one. Hello.
Hello. I thought it was not bad for a duck from outer space.
Mm. David J. Lohr, co-conspirator number two. Hello.
This is why I hate the night shift.
Moises Chuyon, co-conspirator number three. Hello.
Snelzy, I have nothing in my own defense.
And Steve Lutz, co-conspirator number five. Hello.
That's a duck. That's a duck, man.
Also joining us, because, our Monty Ashley. Hello.
Hi, Jason. Is this where I go to breeze this fly trap?
Yep. And Erica Ensign. Hello.
You know, usually I show up for rocket surgeries and I get mad that you guys made me watch something that I end up hating, but I've seen this movie a bunch of times, so I'm here.
Ah, welcome. Welcome. I watched this movie in the movie theater, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Oh, wow.
I have two memories of that. One is a duck going across a bar, which happens. And when the moment happens, 5 seconds of this movie, I pointed at the screen like Leonardo DiCaprio in that animated GIF that everybody puts on the internet and went, yeah, that's it. That's what I remember. And then the other thing I remember was just walking out of the theater into the light of day thinking, were there jokes?
Yeah. The thing I remember from 1986 is Leah Thompson saying, let's watch Letterman.
In Howard the Duck's world, David Letterman's name is David Letterbird.
Sure, of course.
Can confirm.
Howard is from a parallel sort of world that's just like our world, except with ducks.
Except our world is not called People World, whereas theirs is called Duck World.
And there is
everything in their world is puns, mallard card, blooming ducks. It's the United States of Anatidae. These people are more obsessed with who they are than the My Little Pony people.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. So the story is that there's a great Marvel comic, legitimately great Marvel comic from the 70s by Steve Gerber called Howard the Duck. That is a for something coming out of Marvel, which even back then, like, Marvel had sort of its archetypes, and then it did, like, this was just like, why don't we do something totally bizarre? Not quite like the corporate version of an underground comic, I would say. Like, it's great. It's not as wild as like a real underground comic in the 70s, but for Marvel comics, It's Wild, about a duck who comes to Earth and has a girlfriend named Beverly and is in Cleveland. All
those
things.
Duck who is a sarcastic a-hole. That,
yes.
You know, that is funny, genuinely funny at almost mm-hmm. everything he says because of that fact.
Yes.
A genuinely transgressive comic that is adult in a lot of ways that most of the Marvel stuff wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
And that's not what this movie is.
No.
In any way.
You know, it's got very sharp media satire, and this has puns. Mm.
And they're not even sorta. Good puns is the thing. They're not even, they're
no,
not even,
God, no.
They're not even, you know, grade A choice puns. I mean, the comic was good enough that at times it outsold Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
It was succeeding when the X-Men had been canceled due to low sales.
That's right. But this movie went through the process, the film industry process, and came out the other side as something different.
Well, it went through Willard Hulk and Gloria Katz.
Who and Gloria Katz.
I think their whole purpose in life is to show inappropriate things to children, so that was really first and foremost in their minds. But yeah, it went through them, and it came out the other side, and that's what ended up on the screen.
To this day, I disbelieve that Willard Hulk,
yep.
A guy yep. whose last name sounds like something that Goofy says, I doubt that this person actually exists. Like I still have trouble believing he's a real person, because in the history of Hollywood going, hey, here's this thing that we're going to adapt. Here are all these good things about it. Let's do none of the good things.
Yeah.
And let's take all of the stuff that we can cram into it and just paste this label on it. This is maybe one of the best examples of exactly that.
I think George Lucas, who probably bears a large share of the blame here, got something sort of very on brand for George Lucas, the guy who I would say famously didn't understand why people liked Star Wars. I think he didn't understand why people liked Howard the Duck in the comics and then put it through a process. And this is what we got. We're going to get into the movie. I would say one of the things that struck me in watching it again is that it is very 80s. And the thing that I didn't think of when I came out of that theater into the harsh light of day wondering were there jokes is thinking about it in terms of the film trends of the 80s. And this is what struck me this time, which is I'm going to mention two movies, right? Like, so in 84, Ghostbusters was an enormous hit, and it fused comedy with a special effects action adventure style, and it was one of the biggest movies of the year. In 85, Back to the Future did the same. So here comes Howard the Duck in 86. And from the perspective of 2023, I look at Howard the Duck and I especially think, oh, they're doing Ghostbusters. But
no,
without but jokes.
You know what they're doing? Beat for beat, this is a very similar plot to Buckaroo Banzai.
There's a lot of different 80s DNA in here. I
to
was
the
struck
extent that this oh, yeah. or Buckaroo Banzai has a plot.
Yeah, well,
I completely agree.
But it put me in the mind of the Super Mario Brothers movie a little bit. It is because one of the things about this movie is, I mean, where I said, like, was it funny? And the answer is it is at various points trying, I think, to be funny and isn't funny, but like, it's very surprisingly a sci-fi action adventure about a demon beast that is possessed a scientist with a laser spectrometer. By the way, laser spectrometers are not lasers. They just see, they read the light. They don't, anyway.
Do they go, do they break constantly?
Science.
Just all the time malfunctioning?
Yeah, I mean, they're shooting at lasers, Monty, of course. So, and how they've got to stop this demon and his demon buddies from invading Earth and possessing everybody. And I had completely forgotten that that was what this movie is about. And it is such a strange turn to have that going on. But that's what the movie does. And it's also, so it's not even just, it's got a part of like a rom-com sort of where there's a duck and a duck meets a girl. Girl is in a rock band singing in a cage. What's going to happen there? But you've also got, again, a scientist has his brain eaten out by a demon and he's going to try to take over the world with his dark brethren. What a what a thing this movie is. And that goes to what I would say is the fundamental problem with the movie, other than it maybe not really being funny, is at one point halfway through, I wrote in my notes, does this movie have any idea what it wants to be? And I mean, the answer is no.
Nope.
It is a tonal disaster and a sort of topical disaster. And that, I mean, I think there are other reasons why this movie is a failure. I have to admit, I kind of enjoyed watching it because there's a lot of really great 80s stuff in it. But also, I just kept shaking my head like, what? What? What is happening? So it's Howard the Duck. What can
it,
I mean?
It has moments where it's almost charming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's trying. It's talented people in, you know, in the film, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And yet, and like Hook and Cats, they started with American Graffiti.
Yeah.
And I think I said this in Temple of Doom. It's like, how did they get progressively worse with each film?
There's literally a car chase in this movie shot on the same roads as American Graffiti. Because
I think so.
Because I will tell you, friends, this is not a movie that was, although it is set in Cleveland, it is shot in San Francisco. And
well,
Modesto
is the Cleveland of California.
It's very obviously shot in San Francisco and around the bay, where you get these beautiful rolling hills of Sonoma County that are supposed to be Cleveland. Sure, Cleveland.
But supposedly, they considered making this after American Graffiti. Like,
yeah.
Lucas was interested in this back in 1973.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Well,
it didn't work in 86. So
the piece of historical context that I'd throw in here is that Lucas saw this as a meal ticket, and when it flopped, it didn't make all the money that he needed to be able to pay off the gigantic costs of building Skywalker Ranch.
Mm.
And so he sold his animation studio to his friend Steve.
Steve Jobs, yes.
And it became Pixar.
Mm-hmm. Another fallout from this movie that is significantly less important, but I made note of it anyway, is that eventually decided this guy, this one person was responsible for Howard the Duck being made, Frank Price. Frank Price was also the guy who saw the video for the Cheech and Chong song Born in East LA and said, that should be a movie. Cheech should direct it and Chong should not be involved. So when that movie got done, Frank White is out of the picture and they were like, we're not going to promote this at all. To heck with you, Cheech.
Wow. Amazing.
The other Frank Price related anecdote, which I didn't expect us to have one, let alone two Frank Price anecdotes, is that allegedly he and another executive from Universal got into a literal fist fight after a test screening, trying to argue over whose fault the movie was.
So
yeah,
only in the '80s.
I don't know if I can walk through this whole movie. There is so much here, and I took a lot of notes of it. But I want to hit up on a bunch of points. But I want to start with Howard himself. So Howard the Duck is a little person in a suit with an animatronic head that moves its little beak to talk.
A little bit.
A little bit. Which famously they wanted Robin Williams to do the voice, and he came in and he was going to do, I'm going to do a bunch of riffs where I do lots of cultural references that'll be out of date by the time the film comes out. Can I do that? And after 2 days he quit because they're like, no, Robin, you have to match the very slow movements of the beak. Of the Bill animatronic. And he's like, I can't work that way. So they replaced him apparently with a Broadway actor who is boring. And so you've got a non-expressive head on a little weird suit that doesn't really look real. It looks like a suit. And a main character who's doesn't do a lot and is not very interesting and sounds kind of boring. And I do think that is one of the key problems with the movie, is that Howard is not
just
that
a guy.
Interesting.
And never he's doesn't seem a, like a little person in a duck costume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With a dubbed in voice. I was of a boring
It's such a pronounced
guy.
Issue that when they brought Howard back in the comics under writer Chip Zdarsky, he wrote a storyline about how what happens in this movie was a result of mind control and somebody in a bad duck suit. and effectively mm-hmm. brushed it out of even Howard the Duck multiversal lore as just an aberration that doesn't count at all.
I was trying to think of other movies where a human head is inside an animatronic puppet head. The TMNT movies immediately came to mind. Yeah. They started 4 years later. They're so much more expressive than this guy. And he just has the duck, the bill, and the eyes.
Hoggle in Labyrinth is the same year.
Oh, good point.
Mm-hmm. But the Hoggle and the Turtles were built by the Henson Creature Shop, and this was not.
No. No, so that's a real
obviously.
That's a real problem.
Another major problem is that like the Howard the Duck from the comics is basically Donald Duck with a cigar and a suit coat instead of a sailor suit and still no pants. But he looks he looks like what he is, which is a riff on cartoon ducks and supposed to just be kind of like a dirtied up gross version. And Howard in the movie is more or less like this baby-faced cute little squeezable huggable guy. And he's literally the opposite of what you would want if you had, and I went to see this in the theaters too, and I was seeing it having read the comics, and I was like, oh cool, this is going to be sort of transgressive and sort of adult. And the minute that I saw the Howard costume, I was like, this is not what I came for.
It was the pants were the problem.
Well, Howard the Duck in the comics eventually had pants too, due to a suit from Disney, who said, no, there's only room for one pantsless duck in this town.
Can we talk about Howard's clothing briefly? Because he looks bad in every suit.
Well, the suits are all bad, too, but
Like, the clothing in this movie is generally great. I love some of the clothing, but Howard always looks... That's not a duck's body. That's not a human body. I don't know what body they're trying to imply with him is all.
He's very off-putting.
Yeah. It's a mascot.
You know, I think they put all of the focus on duck boobs over duck clothing.
Yep.
And why would ducks have boobs? I don't know. Get
okay,
it.
So there is a scene where
everybody's out there
where
watching
pulled
duck boobs.
He's pulled in his chair backward up into a portal and flung through space and lands on Earth. And along the way, they're like, oh man, this is going to be where we get to expose a whole lot of what's going on Duck Planet. And here's what we're going to do. In one scene, there's going to be a duck lady in a bathtub and she's going to have boobs, but because they're duck boobs and they have feathers on them, it's going to be fine. And it's like, really?
It's not
like,
fine.
And again, like anatomic, first off, it's like, what movie is this again? And
prior to that, he's reading Play Duck.
She's nursing her baby ducks, like, obviously.
You went past him unfolding the duck porn centerfold.
Right.
Mm-hmm, and then we get to the shower.
And by the way, she's Miss October, not Miss Ducktober, which is another issue I have with this movie. Like, sometimes they have duck puns, and sometimes they just don't bother. Like, all the books on Howard's shelves, they're just Earth books.
It just felt really 80s to have a lot of boobs,
yes,
except they were duck boobs. Ooh. But I have to say, like, I had not seen this movie because just the sight of Howard was offensive to me. I'm like, nope. I hated him without seeing the movie. I hate you, Howard the Duck. I've never seen it. And I've only watched it for all of you.
Thank you. I appreciate
You're
it.
Welcome. How people in the movie react to him, by the way.
The duck boobs is weird. So, super weird. Thank you, Steve. Time for a brief break. Let me tell you about our sponsor. This episode of The Incomparable is brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first ever bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less. No thawing required. I got a Wild Grain box. All of it was so good. Fresh pasta, it's frozen, but you boil it, and it doesn't taste like dried pasta. It doesn't feel like dried pasta. It's so good. And the bread, it's bread. It's not dough, but it's not quite done yet. And you put it in the oven, and when it comes out, you would never know that it was in that intermediate state. It is just like fresh baked bread, because it is, basically. There are also pastries. Yeah, get a little apple pie-like thingy that you put in there, pop it in the oven, heat it up. Every item bakes from frozen 25 minutes or less. It's true. And you can customize your box. So you're going to get what you want. Any combination of breads, pastas, and pastries. You want all bread, all pasta, all pastries, you be you. For a limited time, you can get $30 off your first box plus free croissants. What? I want those. in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/incomparable to start your subscription. You heard me. Free croissants in every box. It's raining croissants. Hallelujah. $30 off your first box, too, when you go to wildgrain.com/incomparable. That's wildgrain.com/incomparable. Or just use promo code incomparable at checkout. Thank you to Wild Grain for sending me a box full of bread and for supporting the Incomparable. So, all right. I mean, at one point in my notes, what I wrote down was, you see, they're ducks. Like, there's this whole thing, like, there's ducks playing the $64,000 pyramid, there's Play Duck magazine, there's Miss October, but of course, she, although she is not wearing any clothes, she's completely covered with her feathers. He's got a wide mouth beer bottle, because Bill.
Duck.
Right.
You know,
the beer, by the way, is Birdweiser.
Yes,
although,
of course
although
it
this
is.
Fridge also contains a box that just reads Tyson Fried Chicken. So great job, continuity people.
And then he gets upset about eggs later.
Yeah, yeah, there's a bit of dissonance right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also at the very beginning of the movie, before we even find out that he is a duck, they try to play it like it's a noir detective film sort of thing, with everything's in shadow and you've got the music, and like, it's, I mean, my basic thought about this movie is that it is a terrible movie competently made. So those first scenes are actually not bad. You're like, oh, what kind of movie is this that I'm getting into? The shots are good. The music
and
is
you
great.
Almost think that, and then, you're almost convinced that the reveal of the Howard the Duck costume is going to be really awesome.
And then it's... And then it's Howard.
And Erica, the other thing I would say is there literally anybody who watched this movie who did not say, I would like a ticket to Howard the Duck, or, oh, Howard the Duck is on? Because the way the opening is, it's like, well, what we're going to do, Gloria and Willard, is we're going to like hit people over the head with rocks on the street and drag them into the movie theater. And they're not going to know what movie it is. They're going to think it's like a noir or something. And then it's going to be a duck. And they're going to go, what? It's a duck. But
it's like all those Doctor Who stories where it's something of the Daleks, and the Daleks are a big surprise at the end of episode one. It's like,
I think
no,
know
you can't do that.
What it's going to be. So like the reveal of the duck, and the duck is just not, I mean, I think we can all stipulate, like, one of the big problems, certainly not even close to the only problem, but I think one of the core problems is the duck is just not very good. It's just not good.
I would argue, with all the problems the movie has, that is the biggest one, because it's Howard the Duck.
I know.
Right? You got to nail the duck.
And
well, to be fair, in other countries, I mean, in some countries, it was named Howard and the Fate of the Universe.
Ah, yes.
Howard, a new breed of hero. Howard,
those people
the
were like,
superhero.
Whoa, it's a duck, man. They really were, their minds were blown by it, but the rest of us.
Exactly. So, Howard the superhero, and the poster is him behind a newspaper. Wait till you find out. He's a duck, guys.
And when, here's the thing. Okay, so it's not very effective, but the other follow-on, the knock-on problem with the duck suit is that this is a movie that sort of pivots into being an action-adventure movie. Not only does he have the whole thing where he knows Quack Fu, which apparently is shenanigans involving running between people's legs and hitting them with sticks, which is a very weird martial art, if you ask me. But and then at the end, like that scene that I remember... The reason I remember it is it's a very exciting fight scene in that diner where the duck has to scamper across the bar top, but it's a guy in a suit. He can't scamper very fast. So everything is just slow and and dumb. It's like, it's a guy in a suit. Can, what are we going to do?
He can quite easily be picked up and tossed out of any room he's in.
Mm-hmm.
Apologies to everyone's grandma, but the jokes in this movie, down to the physical comedy business, are like somebody's grandma went, hey, you know what would be hilarious is if then the duck runs on the bar and he falls down. No, grandma, that's actually not very funny, but okay. Okay,
well, grandma has a producer credit. We have to let her do this. She has final cut. I don't know why we gave grandma final cut,
grandma,
but we did.
Gloria.
It's because grandma made Star Wars. So
I think that the action could be fine, except that
it's not.
at the end of the movie. It's action scene, then action scene, then action scene, then action scene.
Yeah.
And all of the action scenes are bad. Yes.
Well, that's what I mean about it becoming
And it's not the end of the movie. It's 45 minutes of the hour and 50 minute movie.
Yeah. No, it transforms. Imagine that. It's there's that little really bit long. In Ghostbusters where it gets to be that where they're on the rooftop and the Marshmallow Man comes and all of that. Like that is their sci-fi action adventure. I'll point out that there are also like 20 jokes in that segment, all of which are very funny. That doesn't happen
what
in
did
this
you do,
movie.
Ray?
But it's like that, but it's way longer. And it's like, you know, who among us doesn't enjoy seeing Jeffrey Jones, the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, trying to take over the world or something. Sure, okay. And a lot of rotoscoped lightning, like in Ghostbusters. You know, the kids love the rotoscoped lightning. Well, let's give
but
them some
Jason,
of that.
What if you're doing the height of vocal performance like this? I'm no longer who I was.
And it's like eventually you get Vincent D'Onofrio in Men in Black doing it really well.
Right.
Again, same concept. But like at the beginning when you said, I don't know if I can walk through the whole movie, the plot is nothing. There's nothing to this plot. It's just because it's so long. Like the ultralight sequence goes on forever and the car chase is forever.
Mm-hmm. The chase with the plane that lasts 15 minutes but feels like an eternity. I've probably got an hour of material that I could just, I haven't prepared because why would I prepare it for this? But there's so much more material to be mined about the movie than is actually in the movie.
Well, so the ultralight, they get in a chase scene because literally Tim Robbins is in this movie, everybody.
Mm-hmm. First
he's
movie.
A scientist,
Super
janitor,
baby Tim
scientist
Robbins.
Janitor, young Tim Robbins. And he's like, oh, we have to escape the cops. Let's steal a car. And it's like, no. What we should do is fix up this ultralight aircraft over here and we use it at daybreak to slowly get away from the cops who can go just as fast as the aircraft can.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give it a point for trying the joke that it's a duck who can't fly.
Yes.
Who's flying.
Yes.
That's a funny concept.
Yes. It's a fun, funny concept, not executed
poorly executed
in funniness.
And apparently that sequence was designed by Joe Johnston, who is good.
Yeah,
it's very clear they're not on a green screen or anything. Every time you get a close up on them, they're moving in air.
And they were actually forced to fly.
It is very clear because in many shots you can see all the wires going up on top and you can it's very strongly implied there is a crane right above that because it's literally just hanging there. I'd say fairly competently done. It doesn't make a lick of sense in the movie. And again, the jokes are like Tim Robbins is like, whoa, and he falls off and he's down at the bottom and he comes up and then yes, it's you know how to fly, Howard, you're a duck, just visualize and fly. And he's like, but I don't know how to fly. I'm like, these are the jokes, everybody. That's why we're here. Is
hilarious.
Somebody wrote down, oh, this is going to be really funny. The duck doesn't know how to fly. And then he has to fly a plane. That's going to be really funny. And then and then Willard and Gloria were like, okay, all right, put some jokes. Joke goes here, TK.
I mean, the scene is basically 15 minutes of the equivalent of young Anakin going, yippee, because that's really all they do is they're like excited that they're flying and then they're not flying.
Now
and then
this is duck racing.
Yeah. And they keep coming back to Earth and then coming back down and up. Like it's really ineffective that it's like you're flying a thing. Stay flying. Why are you going down and then back up? And it's for
the
drama,
kind of flying
I
you
guess.
Have in nightmares.
It is. They should just be swimming in the air.
That's so right. There's no tension, right? Because like you've got the police cops, like the cops at the same pace, just like they could reach out and touch them.
Literally
so
the same. At
zero
one point,
tension.
They basically do, right? At one point, they're like, "Hey, you can get them now."
They're doing these, you know, wacky cop car crashes and everything. And the whole time, I'm going, "Make a Ducks of Hazzard joke." Come on. Well,
Robin Williams would have.
And you know how in some movies there'll be like something in the way, but there's a reason for that thing to be in the way.
Mm-hmm. In like this a pane movie, of glass there's or a truck cart or something.
Yeah,
exactly.
In this movie, there's a truck stopped perpendicular to the flow of traffic.
Yeah.
Just so that police can hit it. It's not going anywhere. Later on, a car is coming down the middle of the road, straddling the double yellow line, honking at other people to get out of the way.
They're on a different car chase.
There's a bridge. They're like, whoa, where'd that bridge come from? Yeah, well, you know.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So, on a positive note, because this is a movie from the 80s. I'm gonna do it. I didn't realize at the time the original songs in this movie, and there are multiple of them, all produced by Thomas Dolby, several of them performed by Thomas Dolby. I love Thomas Dolby. These are not his best songs. I'll point out that
they're kind of catchy though.
They're not bad.
And in fact, the Duck song is pretty okay, actually.
And I can tell that they're Thomas Dolby. The Howard the Duck song is not just Thomas Dolby, it's George Clinton of P-Funk, who was a Thomas Dolby collaborator. They did some songs together on Aliens Ate My Buick. But you
with
can tell
respect,
it's Dolby.
The Parliament Funkadelic does need to pay its bills too.
And so does Thomas Dolby.
No,
and they get this bit and they do the work, and again, Clinton and Dolby work together. And then they also work together on this, and they create songs that I think are fun, at least in the hindsight of being from the 80s, and they're gloriously 80s like. Mm-hmm. And I can also see that the brief was, this is a girl rock band. And so it's like the brief is exactly what they give them. Is like, there's a lot of like tapping on the sticks, 1, 2, 3, count me in, and we're going to do a peppy kind of number. You can tell that was kind of the brief. And that brings me to the other thing that I actually really love about this movie, which is, you guessed it, Lea Thompson.
I think Lea Thompson
is let down by literally everything else in this movie. I think she's kind of great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Wow. Okay. You guys go, and then I'll.
And then you're going to disagree.
I just think
her.
She plays it so straight. Like she is trying so hard to keep this movie on the rails and ground it in some way possible.
She commits to Erica's point. She commits to the worst bits.
She commits to
the absolute worst bits over and over and over again.
In that the love scene, quote unquote, she puts on an absolute tour de force in that scene. She genuinely pulls off that she's into it. You know, she's being real flirty with this dude in a duck suit. And it works. The whole thing works. And it should not. There's nothing in the script or in the dialogue or in the delivery that works, but she pulls it off. And I think that's virtually impossible.
When it comes to 80s movies with Lea Thompson and love scenes, this is less cringy than Tom Cruise or Marty McFly.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I will say also, this movie's gotten a reputation that there's this love scene between a woman and a duck. And it's like, you know, it's kind of not. Mm-mm. Like he's saying stuff and then she's kind of like saying, all right, mister, let's do it. Well, and then he's like, whoa, immediately. He's like, no, I was just kidding. And she's like kind of giving it to him. And there is a little something there, but it is not in that moment. It's not that serious. And the most serious it gets is that they're silhouetted against the paper screen so that the science men who are just letting themselves into the place see it like they're going on hot and heavy. But that's not quite, it's sweeter than that. And that's
Howard
her relationship
gets a feather
with
boner, him. But other than that.
Yeah, but it's sweeter than that. The movie does try
to have it both ways. But I think you're right, Jason. It does lean towards the sweet because early on, like before we get to that bed scene, when Howard's sort of in the windowsill and stuff, you get the very classic romance tropiness of the way that the shots are framed the music and, she tilts her head. And like, I felt very much like the filmmakers were using all of the tricks in their book to convince me that there was a romance that was going to happen
Utterly
between
unearned.
These two characters. Yeah. I didn't actually buy it, but they were trying.
Yeah. That instead of it being an actual romance, which the canonical comics, Howard and Beverly, that is a romance.
Yes.
They played it as you adorable little misogynist. I'm going to take the mick out of you. Making it a playful kind of screwball comedy
He lowers his, right. He's doing that. And then it's revealed once she calls him on it, that it's an act and he's actually terrified. And he's like, no, I was kidding. Right. Like, and it's I like that give and take between them. them, but as Erica said, they're trying really hard. It's kind of unearned. It's unclear how it would work. And also, again, you've got to the point that, like, not only is he a duck, but it's actually just this duck costume that we've been watching, and that there's nothing really excited about that at all. Yeah. And she really should have just stuck with, let's watch Letterman. But
the good news, kids, is Howard does have a condom in his wallet. It's unwrapped. It's unwrapped.
No, which is unwrapped and gross. Yeah,
but he's got it.
Oh, Howard, that's not what you do.
No, but it's made of space age technology that doesn't require an outer wrapper.
Steve, and I don't believe I've ever seen this before. I've never said this before, but Steve,
yeah,
duck penises don't work like that.
Is that right?
Nope. I'll
explain later.
Something of a corkscrew shape, and yeah, it just
doesn't work
that way at all.
Now, that could actually have been a funny joke if he pulled this corkscrew shaped rubber out of his
wallet.
Oh
my God, that would have been so good.
See?
She takes it out and she's like, Never
they
mind.
Weren't sure if people would get the joke if it was something wrapped at that point, because that was still not a common thing in media. And surely they could have thought of a pun for a name of a condom a duck.
These days, you look at that and you go...
A duck rubber for a rubber duck?
We just had an election here in these United States, and you look at that in the movie and you go, oh, it's that thing that I put on my finger to sign the touchscreen to say that I voted.
I was actually really thankful that they didn't get really pervy with the sex, because I'm like, I didn't want to see that, and I was really worried that this is an 80s movie.
The duck boobs really set you up, though, right?
Yes.
You see the duck boobs,
like,
you're like, what
movie
is this?
We had duck boobs, duck porn, or we could have a duck sex scene, and I was like, please no, please no, please no. And I think by that point, I was kind of starting to root for Howard, even though I didn't love it. It's like, oh no, I'm sort of rooting. I want him to succeed. But if this turns into like a full-on romance, I'm not going to buy in. I'm going to check right out. So the thing I am thankful for today is they kept it at sweet and didn't make it pervy.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been terrible if there'd been anything pervy in this movie.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Yeah. It would be terrible if something, you know, something as sweet as this was played off were, countermanded by a hot tub themed sex club.
Yeah. I was as the Wikipedia summary calls it, a romance spa.
Yes. Oh, I called it the orgy store. That's what I wrote down.
Yes.
I'm Phil Rizzuto for the orgy store.
I'm just a plumber at the orgy store, okay? I like clean up after it. That's what I'm here for. I got to fix a duct.
That's
not a duct.
A place where you want to be a plumber.
It's not a duct that I'm fixing. It's a duct, okay? Let's make that clear.
How did all this hair get in here?
I don't think they make a duct joke either. He's fixing a duct. So speaking of 80s movies and 80s character types and all of that, I will say that Lea Thompson and some of her dialogue and the way she talks really fast at various points, I thought was picking up a little bit of like Jordan from Real Genius. I got a little bit of that vibe in there too, that some of that was going on. This is also a movie about lasers that threaten the world. I mean,
and Tim Robbins has a certain Real Genius vibe.
And Tim
going
Robbins
on.
Absolutely has a little bit of that as boy scientist. By the way, did you notice Tim Robbins' character arc? His preferred career trajectory as well. I have to do some cleaning up and stuff now because I'm still a student. But when I graduate, I'm going to get my own museum.
Museum? What?
That happens? That's how that works? That's your plan?
I liked Tim Robbins a lot. He made me laugh twice in this movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's excellent.
Once by calling pizza a circular Italian food object. And once by smiling excitedly when he tells Howard, I got arrested. I'm going to have a criminal record.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He's mad about it later. But in that moment, he's thrilled that he got arrested. I think that's a very funny choice.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he says, let's take the ultralight instead of stealing the cop car, which would have been a much more reasonable.
Oh, he is very game for this role. And I think he pulls it off. I don't think the acting lets this movie down in any respect.
No, absolutely.
Monty? Please tell us your feelings.
Lea Thompson
about Lea Thompson
is so bad in this movie, you guys. She's so bad. Here's Lea Thompson in this entire movie. Oh, Howard. Oh, I'm going to talk very softly and breathily, and I'm not going to do anything but get captured. I'm going to sing a song now in this same voice. That's when she's in the cage at the beginning. She's no energy at all. All from Lea Thompson for me. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I see what you're saying because there are times when the script requires her to do that kind of stuff, but I see other times where I don't feel that way. So but
this is her performance, not the dialogue.
Monty, I would defend myself relative to the rest of the movie. When this
interesting argument
to your point, substandard, very mawkish kind of stuff. When that is what I'm grasping at, it really says more about the rest of the movie that I'm trying to forget than anything else.
Yeah, actually, Monty, I think that's a really good point, because maybe the lack of energy that you were seeing, that you were bouncing off of, that might be what I kind of glommed onto and felt like, because Tim Robbins, I love him, but he's at 11 and that's just too much for me and I couldn't handle it. Whereas maybe she's at a 2 and she should be at a 6 or something like that. But I liked the 2 because I couldn't
Sweet
handle
relief.
Like, it was basically it was the math of all of the different that, you know, I needed her to sort of balance it out. Maybe that's it.
If you think he's at 11 now, you should see Tapeheads, which is actually what he made after Howard the Duck. He was in Top Gun before Howard the Duck, though.
I see what you're saying. I like her a lot. I'm going to admit that I'm from the 80s, and so seeing Leah Thompson as rock girl dressed up in 80s rock gear, playing with a band behind a cage, and then I watched this, and then I reported back to Lauren about it, and I said, well, Leah Thompson does spend a large portion of one scene just walking around in her underwear, so
yep.
That mm-hmm. that was good.
Yep.
That's a little Hoik and Katz magic.
I mean, I'm not good. That's like, that was my favorite scene in the movie, basically. So, okay. All right. Fine. Okay.
Fair.
But I also think it is all, I think it's relative levels.
Yeah. That's really the money shot right there, is when after she's been tromping around in her skivvies, she wants to watch Letterman. It's like, oh no.
Yeah.
You're the perfect woman.
But one of the things that did drive me crazy was yes, her going, Howard, 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 and Howard going, Filzy, Filzy, Filzy. It's like, shut up. We know their names.
Yeah, that's not.
Stop it.
It's not. No, that and like I said, I look at that and I'm like, oh, well, here's the movie, you know, insisting that she do this. But is it annoying, Monty?
Yeah, it is.
I just, there are other parts of her performance that I kind of enjoy. And I think it is levels, like Moises said, but I would also say she doesn't feel like the reason this movie's a failure. And I feel like Leah Thompson, the actress, is maybe trying, like when she's doing stuff, it's more of the stuff that I like in the movie. And when she's not, the movie frequently gets worse to me, but I can see why you would hate it. I totally can. I get it. Yep. But I enjoyed her performance. And I have not seen a lot of Leah Thompson performances where I've been like, hey, good job, Leah Thompson, right? Like, we all know Back to the Future and all that, but like this one, I was like, oh, she's doing something a little bit different, and she's kind of a winning performer here. I enjoyed
it. She went from the failure of this to doing some kind of wonderful just to do anything, even though she originally didn't want to make that. And that's one of her best performances, which came out of the desperation of coming
Howard
out of this. Another redeeming, that's going too far. Not redeeming. A thing that I like about the movie is that you have some of the more archetypal 80s generic roving punk gang of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Punks.
Like that's
quiet
that,
punks.
That for me. Yeah. That's a thing that I found solace in while trying to escape various corners of this movie.
Oh man.
I love
the punks.
Mid 80s unthreatening movie punk.
Yes. It's so good.
And by the way, this movie was made the same year as Star Trek IV.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, see? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, after he's thrown out of the club for being a child in a costume, which, I mean, almost, there is the punks, and they threaten him, punk rock punks. They're not just punks, but they're also punks. You get me? Like, they're punks who are punks. Anyway, that's when he fights them with his quack fu, which involves, again, shenanigans, running through legs and hitting people with sticks, because that's real martial art on Duck Planet or whatever. There is a moment.
But it's in the service of stopping an imminent sexual assault on
Leah
Thompson, which, you know, more fun stuff for the kids.
Yeah, for the kids. Yeah. For the kids, along with a duck. I mean, they're so blinded by the duck boobs still. They're thinking about the duck boobs, Woo! Steve. They're not even thinking about this part.
I mean, that's all I'm thinking about.
So there is a bit that is actually sort of subtle that I actually really did like, which is after they meet, There's that moment of where Beverly is like, takes him home and she's like trying to feed him. And she says, do you want milk in a bowl? And he looks at her and he's like, how about a beer? And she's like, oh, a beer. Sure. Whatever. And she goes. And then he says very quietly to himself, I'll put you in a bowl.
And I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
It's just mean. And I like that. I like, now he's good. Being mean. I like
that's
it.
Closer to the spirit of the original Howard the Duck. Right, and also, yeah. I like the bit where he says under his breath when he notices the size of the beer bottle.
Yeah.
Big beer.
Yeah. Yeah. And she says, look, I don't even know what to do here. I haven't even had a pet. I don't know about cleaning up their poo-poo, she says. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is the moment where Howard should say, oh, Beverly, you should understand. I have a cloaca. And so pretty much I just wherever I want.
Right.
And also,
if you got any wine bottles that are in need of opening, I got you covered there too.
But that doesn't happen. Yeah. Anyway, let's see what else is in here. So our scientists, the science men come when they're having their like moment in bed, silhouetted, and it's a group of science men brought by Tim Robbins to figure out. They found a feather in the laser lab, and they're gonna do a feather match to one of his tail feathers. And it turns out that there's a laser. Their laser brought him there, but there's also the laser brings a demon that inhabits Geoffrey Jones. And in a, I would say, kind of a cool moment when Geoffrey Jones is completely taken over, he does the thing because he's going back and forth with the voices as he's being possessed. And he goes, I'm dead. I'm dead. Yes, you are. And that's the end of Geoffrey Jones as a human being until the end where he's miraculously brought back. Okay.
His hair gets fixed, too. It's nice of them.
And his face and nails and everything
is pressed for that. Yeah.
Howard goes back and forth between really wanting to get home and really being a jerk whenever he's asked to help out, get him home.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Like when he's first taken to Tim Robbins, or Filzy, as he's apparently known.
Oh, that's his name.
As soon as he's asked any questions, like, screw you, I'm leaving. I'm like, what? You could just
where?
Stick around. Where are you go? Yeah,
where are you going?
Yeah, I just have to complicate the script, okay? All right.
And also just the whole him being pulled from Duck World into our world, it didn't ever really make any sense, because it's not like it was just a random thing that landed someplace on Duck World. It's specifically him and his chair being pulled through a building, through other objects and things. And then later there's this like throwaway line about how as they were testing the laser, some sort of force pulled it off course. And, you know, maybe that was supposed to be the dark, I don't know, beastie guys, whatever, but it's never really explained, which I'm kind of okay with, because they didn't need to make it any longer or add any more things to this movie. But it's just like, I was hoping for maybe just like for that bit of the movie to hold together for me. And no, they didn't even give me that.
Erica, this is a movie where somebody who ostensibly works at a nuclear power plant says the word nuclear.
Yes, it is.
That happened. I have been watching a number of things from that era, and it happened a lot.
It did.
That's a
Jimmy Carter said nuclear, and he was a nuclear physicist.
I mean, my dad worked in the electrical power industry.
Yeah, but he was also Jimmy Carter, Monty.
So many people said nuclear.
Anyway, that Cleveland, the Cleveland nuclear plant is in Sacramento. So it's Rancho Seco. So
wait, Jason, you're telling me that bizarrely West Coast Californian Cleveland is not actually reflective of Cleveland, Ohio?
I mean, people in Cleveland can write in about like vast valley expanses with a couple of cooling towers in the middle of it. Maybe their nuclear plant looks like that too, but that's not where they shot the movie. I had Dynatechnics, by the way, a great fake name.
That's a wonderful name
for you know, the office park where they claimed that this laser is for. David Paymer, by the way, is one of the laser scientists there. So that's
one of the things I laughed at the end credits. His character is credited as Larry Scientist.
Larry Scientist, yeah, indeed.
I like that.
There are lots of scientists.
Look,
and he's one of them.
It's
It's a throwback to when people's surnames reflected their occupation.
So I wanted to
nominative destiny.
Back up before they go home and watch David Letterman and all of that.
We oh, do are get, we doing this in order, Jason?
No, we're not. We're doing it all the way out of order.
Make it longer.
But I want. Well, this is stuff that I want to mention though. Is that there's that scene where Howard overhears the club owner and their manager, the band's manager, stiffing them of their money. And Howard basically gets in a fight with them and takes over. And then he goes and meets the girls in the band afterward, including Holly Robinson Pete from 21 Jump Street. She's one of the people in the band.
And
there.
Liz Segal from Grease 2 and the Double Mint Twins ads.
See, there you go. Mm. But there is a character in there that I want to say, one of the thugs. I kind of love that guy because he has two of my favorite lines in the movie. He is the like dumb, weird thug who's at the end of the bar and who gets in the fight with him later. And one of the things they're like, the duck appears and says, listen, buddy, you're not going to screw these girls out of their money. And the thug at the end of the bar says, I told you you'd be dealing with different lifestyles in the entertainment industry. That's great. And then later where Howard like says, back off. I got space rabies. I'll bite your
Richie,
face.
Richie, is that a real disease?
And he says, I don't know, Ginger. I heard something about that on the news.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I love I wrote that character. That down too.
So strange. So specifically weird.
And that, by the way, is the parking garage attendant from Ferris Bueller's Day Off who takes off with Cameron's dad's Porsche.
Oh, amazing. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Richard Edson was also in the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Of course.
In addition to this, yeah, he was in Ferris Bueller, but then he was also in Do the Right Thing. So it's like, look, all over the if place. I had to be in Howard the Duck and Super Mario Brothers to be in Do the Right Thing, I think I would take that deal.
And this is the weird thing, is for a movie that is not that funny, then suddenly there's this totally weird side character who's doing weird stuff and making jokes. I'm like, I don't know how that character was allowed in this movie, but
I think you can just assume that's probably on the actor and not on anybody else involved in the film.
It's just funny lines. Again, it's like, it's the entertainment business, buddy. There's lots of strange lifestyle. And they're like, a duck is a lifestyle.
I heard something about that on the news.
On the news. Just why is that guy there? But I don't know. Anyway, they go to Dynatechnics and there's, you know, some sort of planetary alignment mumbo jumbo or whatever. And Tim Robbins wants to take Howard and put him on TV, but they're not going to do that because. And then like, yeah, so then we're in the action part of the movie. Basically, like the cops come and they arrest him and they're going to take him to jail because he's an illegal alien. And
I want to talk about the police for a second.
Yes, please.
Because I do not understand why Tim Robbins got arrested. They had Howard like confined before he was arrested. He just made up illegal aliens. I don't understand why he wanted to arrest Howard either.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
The cops show up at this lab and just start arresting people for no reason. And then they spend the rest of the movie chasing them.
Supposedly, Filzy didn't have clearance to be in there when he was. That's what the plot summary
says.
But
then there's a laser explosion.
Yeah. So I have a theory about this that doesn't rely on trying to make actual sense of it.
Okay, good.
The reason that works in the movie's favor is part of why this movie became such a hit among people of a specific age who caught it on rotation on HBO that, you know, considered it a classic of their childhood, because it makes absolutely no sense in the same way that loads of stuff from, G.I. Joe and Transformers cartoons do, where it's like, why are they arrested? Because they needed to be.
Because, yeah, that's exactly right.
I was going to say, by the way, earlier, Jason, when you were saying who's going to see this movie without knowing it's called Howard the Duck, the answer is a 9-year-old
on watching HBO. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yep. So also there's a moment where Leah Thompson takes the cop's gun and holds it on the cop. It is Howard the Duck, people. Howard the Duck. And our heroine has just taken a cop's gun and is pointing at the cop. I mean, the cop is bad because he's like going to arrest Howard or whatever. And she wants to get out of there. But she's holding the gun. And I had that. It just popped into my head. It just popped in. I was like, wow, imagine if she just shot the cop right then.
Yeah, the logic of the movie works in the world of kids playing outside, which I know kids don't do anymore, where nothing makes sense and you can pull a gun on a cop and everything's fine at the end.
It's
and she cocks it at one point,
yes,
too. She's
yes,
ready
yes,
to go.
This is what she's doing. Literally the moment in my notes where I finally wrote down, what is this movie doing? The tone is entirely wrong. What are you doing? So the
we're
doc's,
back in a noir.
Yeah. The doc sees something in the laser explosion. He's been possessed by the thing. And then there's a car chase with dramatic music because it's John Barry doing the underscore here. And at several points, the score is like James Bond level score, which for John Barry, right, makes sense. And it's like entirely inappropriate for a movie like this.
And here's one thing that got me in about the score. One of the motifs that he keeps using is 'Tis a Joy to Be Simple from Aaron Copland. And it's,
of course, yes,
it
you would.
Makes no sense
as you
in
would.
This movie.
Simple gifts. Yes.
Yeah.
What is a simpler gift than Howard the Duck? So they
you
crash
hear it once and then it just keeps coming back.
They crash into a diner, but it's Joe Roma's Cajun sushi, which is nonsense. And I thought, why is it just an opportunity for some light 80s racism? And the answer is
I don't know how light it was, Jason. It felt like
when you get there, you're thinking, maybe it's the light racism. Then you get to the point where there is an Asian cook sharpening his cleaver because he's going to try to chop Howard's head off. And I was like, oh, that's not why so all of this has led up to this.
Because duck.
Yeah.
And everybody's got Imperial Japanese battle flag bandanas on.
Yeah.
So the thing that gets me.
They're making
got
a Peking duck joke, I guess. Like the whole, this is all the way.
But Peking, Beijing is Chinese and this is supposed to be like they're not even getting the racism
right. I don't know.
And he's way too big.
It's a diner. No, it is like Mel's Diner. It is literally like a 50s diner. Except they've added this element to it. I don't.
Japanese are taking over,
and
Jason.
This is where the duck is slowly scampering around. The only thing I would find a value in here is that actually this is the, you know, you get those movies where there's the super baddie and everybody's trying to like come on, you let us go and all of that. And in this scene, Leah Thompson and Howard are like talking to Jeffrey Jones and like and they kind of convince him. He's like, oh. I mean, I want to destroy the earth, but you're right. These people are awful, and I should blast a bunch of these people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and see, one of the things I have written down for this scene, because it's also filled with straight up rednecks.
Yep.
Right. Just like Mel's Diner.
Enacting a lynch mob on a duck person.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like,
well, they're Hicks
they could have done some
other part of Ohio, I guess.
They could have done duck season, redneck season. Duck season, redneck season. Nope.
If it's a Cajun sushi place, how come the chef's special is just eggs and
I don't
browns?
Know, right? It's actually just a diner.
Like before we even get into the diner, on viewing it this time, the thing that leapt out at me is that the sign outside says Joe Roma's Cajun and sushi is covering up something. What is sushi replacing in the name of
ribs?
Joe Roma's Cajun diner doesn't Cajun diner, is that a thing?
I mean,
Joe Roma's Cajun what was replaced
Cajun,
with sushi?
Cajun looks like it's kind of plastered on there too, so I don't know.
But the diner scene does have the one funny line in the movie for me, which is as Jeffrey Jones is starting to really kind of get grossed out and, you know, has various scribblings emanating from his eyes and like explosions just superimposed over his eyes at one point.
Yes. All those rotoscoping and yeah.
Yeah. One of the workers at the diner looks over and says, he must have ate the chili, which I thought was a pretty good joke.
I liked when the waitress said, oh, they fight in here all the time.
Yeah.
Yes. Completely ignoring the riot.
Actually,
that was
funny. When the waitress brings the eggs and Howard is offended by eggs, there is this moment where the waitress leaves. And again, it's these side characters where she's doing a little business where she's like, I don't even know why they ordered the, she's complaining about it. And it's like, yes, waitress, their behavior doesn't make any sense. You have the sense to know that this, they don't make any sense.
But, yeah, David can keep rewriting it line by line, but I think the big picture stuff would be more interesting. Like, why don't we Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Howard the Duck, and this waitress, and this other side character, and this other thing?
Right, they're already so much more interesting.
Yeah,
yeah.
And this is where he does the scamper across the bar top that I remember from watching this in 1986, and it is as slow and not dramatic as you might expect for a guy in a suit going across the bar top.
The duck person version of what happens in Picard season 2. Where they chase
a very elderly man slowly of a vineyard. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's also the second time in the movie he walks across a bar.
You're looking
it reminded me of the gag in Spaceballs where the alien bursts out of John Hurt's chest and then does Hello My Baby up and down the bar, and I think he does it a little faster than Howard.
Yeah, the and Monty, to your
point, it's a puppet.
They slide him down the bar also earlier, and that's dynamic because he doesn't have to walk. They just put him down there. But when he walks, mm-hmm. everything slows down, and it's not that. Anyway, this is followed by the speaking of slow speed chases, the ultralight chase through the Central Valley of Cleveland, and the ultralight aircraft is clearly suspended by the wires above it. But another thing that I thought here, and this is, I know that George Lucas produced it, but, you know, Steven Spielberg's a friend of his. And what we learned in the summer of Spielberg, one of the things is, one of the bad signs in a Spielberg movie is it starts to feel like it's a theme park attraction. And the ultralight felt very theme park to me, very like structured and, oh, we're going to, don't worry, you're not actually flying, but it'll feel like you're flying sort of as you're slowly moving around in this thing.
My problem with the ultralight is that the danger comes from the pad flying and not the people that are chasing it.
Right. You forget about them for a while until you see that they're pacing the ultralight
running
on the
into
road.
Trucks parked perpendicular on the freeway. It's
15 minutes that feels like an hour. Yeah. Intercut with the alien thing possessing Jeffrey Jones having apparently fetish tied Beverly in the back of a truck.
Yes.
And it just
more of that Huick and Cat's magic.
Oh, the kids are gonna love it.
If you compare this chase to a good chase like the one in What's Up Doc, you'll find that in that the entire movie is spent making sure everybody wants to chase these two, and then they're right on the tail of them in the entire chase. Here the cops vanish completely.
Yeah, it could be two separate chases happening actually.
There's that one shot where it's from the side and you see that they're all over the water and the cops are on
that's
the
unrelated.
Road.
That's another cop chasing
somebody
else.
Oh, it's a different cop, right? But yeah, that's a moment where I'm like, oh, right, there's a chase going on and it's not just shenanigans with people who don't know how to fly a plane. Oh, right. Okay. Yes. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Jones is at the nuclear power plant because he needs to feed on power. He needs a million kilowatts of power. If only there were a term for that, would it be megawatts?
Gigawatts.
Gigawatts, maybe. I don't know. He uses his telekinesis, by the way, to get to the power at the nuclear core, which is apparently just a white room. It's a white room. That's
cool.
What,
no one seems too bothered by that. There's just like a thin door in between that.
And then there's just a white room, and that's where the power is. It's in a nuclear plant.
That's
where
they keep the power. You don't want to make it too hard to get to.
No, because you need it. You gotta get it out.
Gotta
to
have that power.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's none of this China syndrome stuff. It's fine.
Oh man.
It's fine.
So
when they get to the scientific establishment, the doors to defense research are not terribly strong either.
No.
So.
Also, there's a roadblock. So when Jeffrey Jones and Leah Thompson are trying to get to the scientific establishment for the laser, there's a roadblock in the way that they're doing like an inspection of, it's like a smog check on the street inspection, right? And
well, it's California.
And this is not acceptable to the demon that is possessing Jeffrey Jones. And so he basically explodes all the cars in the roadblock. And I wrote down in my notes, I guess all those people died or something.
But they showed them running away.
I don't know.
Like everybody,
did they all get out
away,
of the cars?
I don't know if everybody got away.
They all explode. Anyway,
at this point, I was ready to see some people die, though, so it wasn't a big deal. Yeah.
The Nexus of Somnus is where we're going. I just want to be clear again: spectroscopes do not fire lasers. But
and they jumble together like in a case of them actually using something from the comics. Somnus is from the comics, and it's a realm.
Yeah.
But did they name the entity that Jeffrey Jones is possessed by? No. You want to know why? Because his name is Thog.
Sure.
I Thog. Will say that the set is very cool. There's a giant laser in it.
Yeah.
It's a giant physical set.
Yeah. Actually, it's the best match for the John Barry score because it's very much a James Bond villain thing with his James Bond score that he's playing there. But, of course, in the middle of it is a duck driving a golf cart.
another laser beam.
With another separate laser on it. We do finally get the joke, which is like, Howard, duck! and proud of it. He says,
"Wait, Jason, you said finally, as if anyone was really anticipating, well, waiting, hoping against
Moises,
hope."
Moises, I think what I would say is there was a list that Gloria and Willard had of duck jokes they were going to make, and they're like, "Oh man, yeah, like we got to tell them to duck at some point." And this is it. They're like, finally here. Duck.
They're like, but we got to hold it. We got to hold it.
Oh yeah,
for,
you
like,
got to save it for the climax where our hero is driving a golf cart. Anyway, there's a lot of nonsense where he fires the thing and is like, oh, and he saves Jenning, the scientist played by Jeffrey Jones. He's back somehow, as we said, like, okay, he's fine, but the monster is still there. He's now a stop motion crab monster.
Well, I mean, he's sort of fine. He's still a pedophile.
Well, that's true.
I'm going to say, I love the monster as
crab monster.
The special effects. Yeah. I was like,
Bill Tippett.
This to me is the best part of the movie. It's very retro. It's delightful. And then we have like extra ones that appear a little later. Mm-hmm. Best part of the movie.
Going down the beam. The other crab monsters coming down the beam.
I'm cheering for the monsters at this point because that chase scene was too long. I'm watching the clock. Yeah. Just
See,
eat everybody.
I would have enjoyed all that stuff a lot more if it hadn't happened after 6 hours of chase scenes.
Oh, yeah.
By the time it arrives, it's too late to save the movie.
If this movie were 45 minutes shorter, it'd be fine.
Probably.
Yeah.
I don't know about fine, Monty, but it would be better.
Well, I mean, think the duck needs to be better. We're almost at the end. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's where he saves, Howard saves the day. Okay, the end.
He saves the day, but he can never go home. It.
The movie that precedes this does not deserve the amazing motion control, stop motion creature stuff that we see in the last 5 minutes of the movie.
It's better than the Terror Dogs and Ghostbusters, right? Like, it's really well done in this movie. And again, I will say, I don't know why this is what this movie wants to be, right? I feel like that's the part that baffles me.
Oh, Jason, do you think this movie really knows what it wants to be?
Well, it clearly doesn't, but I know what I think it should be, and it's not this chase scene sci-fi action stuff that is at the end here, because I think, would it be a good movie? I don't know, as long as you've got that duck suit and animatronic, I don't think it would be a good movie, but like, the stuff that I walked away thinking is fun, at least, is Beverly and the band, and Howard is their manager, and punks are on the streets of the city threatening people, and Tim Robbins has got is like providing science explanations and help, even though he may be a janitor. All that stuff that's like human scale is interesting and quirky and weird, even though it doesn't really come off, and the duck costume is a problem. But this last 45 minutes is just, what if we did, again, like Ghostbusters? What if we were like, well, no, now it's just going to be monsters and lasers and stuff and car chases. And
yeah, if the 45 minutes you took out was all the parts with the duck, then maybe you'd have something.
I mean, the duck is the problem, clearly.
If you had a better duck, I mean, what are you going to do?
If I had a
then you're
going
to need some sauce to go with it.
But if you had that focus on the duck out of water, and it's just a normal duck story. It's not a big science fiction epic.
Yeah.
If you focused on media satire and the fact that this is not a man, it is a duck, and then they just go on with a normal human story, that would have been more fun. It would have also been more like the comic.
The plot of Wayne's World, by the way, is essentially a weirdo gets a girlfriend who is out of his league and is concerned about her band not being taken advantage of. And it's a perfectly fine movie. And I believe in Wayne's World there are no stop motion crab monsters. So there you go.
There's
you
one,
forgot that part.
Okay, well, voice of
I think
there's
Chris not.
I
think there's remnants of a better storyline for Howard in the movie. Because right when he gets to Beverly's, there's that thing about how, well, I'm an advertising copywriter. I could never make it in music.
Right.
And like, she's a musician, and here we go. So this is right? No, nothing.
Yeah, he can write songs and perform, and he already has gotten her out from under her bad manager. And like, wouldn't it be funny to have a duck be in the music business, in the cutthroat music business. It's like the movie is like, not really. No, no. How about a demon from space who rode to Earth on a laser? Okay.
And the cutthroat music business of Cleveland, Ohio.
Of Cleveland. Well, that's okay. I mean, hardscrabble Cleveland, Ohio.
I mean, some of the biggest laughs in the movie are every time Beverly mentions her career. Her vivid and vibrant yeah. career.
Of singing in a cage at a dive.
Singing in a cage in Cleveland, Ohio.
The audience at that cage show is not interested in them at all, no. by the way. Nope. They're not even no. clapping.
Well, it nope. also makes me laugh that the money that their manager is withholding from them is like $600 bills.
It's this you're just tiny say little $6. Yeah. $6.
And that's from all of their performances. Right. The big finale at the end, again, is it's the super happy ending thing where they're at it's the Warfield in San Francisco, by the way. And I know all the scenes in this movie because I'm very good about, I'm an expert in Cleveland. But in this moment, and it's just like, I was like, oh, okay, I guess we're going to do this. Just like, this song is dedicated to our new manager. Nothing like having a big dedication from the stage to management. That's like thanking your agent. Like, come on. But they're not, at least they're no longer singing in a cage. So he's done something right. And they sing a song called Howard the Duck about Howard the Duck, that mm-hmm. Howard the Duck comes on stage and almost Marty McFly like is given a duck guitar and allowed to perform as they perform a song written again by Thomas Dolby and George Clinton, doing their best imitation of Prince, I will say. And it is Howard the Duck. Anyway,
Prince scoring with radically more simplistic lyrics than Prince would
well,
ever
sure,
use.
But the tone of the song, they're like, clearly it's like we're trying to do a
Prince
would have
definitely
Purple
thrown some
Rain
duck
kind of number
in
here.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this, but with and all the, thank you, Steve. You can't woohoo your own duck boobs. Come on.
I beg to differ.
Well, Steve can, if anyone can.
Yeah, Steve.
Anyway, this movie obviously cost a lot of money. And at the end, all I could think was, whoa, where do you see the bill?
Oh. See?
Good night, everybody.
See you next week.
Woohoo.
that was almost as obvious as the thing that the lyrics of the songs prior to and including Howard the Duck at the end, what they do is what people who hate musicals think that all musicals do, where they go, I don't know why you're not talking to me.
Right.
I don't know what went wrong. Two people who had so much together really ought to get along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a story told.
But something started to change inside of you. These are actual lyrics from one of the songs.
Yeah.
Where the underscore lyrics are just describing what's happening on screen.
You know, yeah. I hope that Thomas Dolby and George
I'm assuming that
George
song
Clinton
was a
paid.
Huge hit well, on the radio. Because, you know, that's so catchy.
In the States, yes, but not in
was
Canada.
It?
So that's why you didn't
was
know it,
Annette. I'm like,
yeah. That was huge.
What
people
is wrong
doing
with you
the,
all?
Doing the
it
duck.
Should not be a hit.
Oh, it was huge in Cleveland. I mean, San Francisco. I mean, Cleveland.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was there a dance offices. Move to go with it?
So, you know, in
what
the
have
end,
we learned, Jason?
Yeah, what? No, that's where we are. What have we learned? What I learned is I see sort of what they were trying to do with some of the bits of it, which was try to follow the lead of other more successful movies. Like I said, I really watched this and thought, oh, somebody saw how big Ghostbusters was, especially, and was like, that's it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do a comedy with an action adventure story and we're going to put it together. And then somebody left out the comedy part because it's just not funny and the duck is kind of broken. But what the fondness that I feel for this movie, having watched it again, is it's super 80s and there are the parts of it, especially that are not part of the plot, that involve very 80s music and hairstyles and costumes and tropes from 80s movies and all of that stuff. In the 80s, you're like, it's a movie. But in the 2020s, you go, it's an 80s movie. And that makes a difference. So this movie is a mess. I don't think it could ever have been successful with the animatronic duck, but but it's broken beyond that, I want to say. It's not just the duck. It really is very broken in terms of its tone and its screenplay. But there were parts of it that I found charming. It may be charming in how ramshackle they are, but that I found kind of charming. Is it a, in the parlance of the Flophouse, I would say, I think this is a good bad movie.
Mm, yeah. I could not more vehemently disagree. it's just a bad movie. Tim Robbins telling stories about the making of the movie. Most of his, all of his fond memories are about how much money he made because the movie was so over schedule. Doing reshoots.
People involved in this movie would say that.
Hold on. They did tons and tons of reshoots on this movie.
Well, you had to get it right.
What did this movie look like before the reshoots? If this is what we got,
was it better?
What was it like?
It had more chase.
Oh, imagine how many times that puppet head messed up.
Yeah. I heard about it on the news.
Radio control.
Oh God! it's a bad. It's a bad movie. There's no doubt about it.
Actually, they just reshot that dude in the bar.
Like literally, I think the reason that I this time through I was like, oh, is that it is so 80s that it took me back to 1986 in a way that I found fun. But boy, it's nonsensical the way that it's put together. It can't even find a tone and then lose it. It does not know what it wants to be.
It switches tones within seconds in a single scene.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In sentences, even.
Yeah.
Like it's a miracle when a movie actually gets completed, and an even bigger miracle when that completed movie is actually good. And this movie just had a bunch of the wrong ill-fitting parts plugged in the wrong places. And anybody who was in a position to say no
right.
To the right things and yes to the even more right things, nobody was doing that.
And nobody, I suspect, could go to George Lucas and say, George, mm-mm. Right. Mm-mm. He's like, he's Mr. Star Wars. Erica, you said you watched this a lot. Explain yourself.
I don't know about a lot. I think I must have seen it on VHS when I was a kid. And I think this movie, as you said, it doesn't know what it wants to be. It changes tone. It's got all of these pieces of these different types of movies. And I think, I don't know, maybe as a youngster, I was just like, each of those pieces entertained me on their own. And I didn't care so much about it hanging together. It's entirely possible. I didn't even watch it in one sitting because, you know, kids, VHS, we had outside to go to. And I watched it again years later with some friends. And we it's terrible. But we enjoyed the experience of watching it together and laughing at how bad it was. And when I heard you guys were going to do it, I was like, well, I will absolutely watch that movie again. And yeah, it was kind of the same thing. I think I just knew how bad it was that I was not actually expecting anything. So each of those little moments that were entertaining or put together well or shot well or the music was good, like this is a really terrible, terrible movie. It is not good. Okay. But it was made by people who are so talented that that contrast in my head just was hilarious to me. And you know, I'll probably end up watching this again someday. I admit it. It's a bad movie. I recognize it. I'm never going to try to encourage anybody else to watch it.
No.
Except my spouse, who I made watch it with me.
Oh, good. Well, he deserves it.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, he was going to have to edit this podcast anyway. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I like this movie kinda sorta, but it's awful.
It's a movie she kinda likes.
I did like that they spent the money to get Richard Kiley to read one paragraph.
Yeah, they spared no expense.
For no reason. I mean, that narration is totally unnecessary.
No, completely.
Just so they can put the title card up and say Howard the Duck and have somebody say Howard the Duck at the same time.
Yeah. Annette, what'd you think?
Well, I think that, you know, I never got out of expecting it to go back to being a noir movie. But I kind of think that might have made it better if I was going to pick a genre, stick with noir. But I hated it less than I expected it to. And
raves on that Weirstra.
Yeah, it was. I think it's partly that nostalgia that Jason's talking about. It's like, oh, the 80s. I really love that. I love that decade. And I loved watching so many things. And there are all these actors that I'm like, oh, I love these actors and all these elements I appreciated. And I think in that there was something enjoyable. Was it good? No, it was terrible. It's really terrible. I don't know that I would watch it again. Maybe if Erica really talked nice to me and we had drinks or something, I would do it
Lots
with her.
Lots of drinks.
Yes. But, you know, do I regret watching it? No, because then we get to mock it with all of you. So,
I mean, about halfway through in my notes as I'm watching it, I'm going, well, that's Emilio Lizardo and that's the dimension barrier, and that's and I just wrote down Duckaroo Banzai.
Yeah,
also that's the plot.
Yeah,
it's a better joke than most of the ones in the movie.
It's true.
It is. Thank you.
And
thank
proud you. Of it.
That's right.
It was a pretty low bar, David. Don't get over it.
Yeah, no, I'm,
Monty.
I slithered over it.
What is your overall feeling about Howard the Duck?
I like bad movies that are bad because nobody has any idea what they're doing, because then you get really crazy decisions. This is a movie where made by competent people that still makes a lot of crazy decisions. And I like that even more. The fundamental problem with this movie is at the fundamental of this movie. And, you know, people are good actors in it.
Yes.
But they're acting such bad lines that there's no hope of saving the scene. I think so that's very funny.
You can write
also,
these things, George.
In the IMDb trivia, Leah Thompson complains that she spent 2 hours a day getting her hair done and she should have worn a wig. I'm glad she didn't, because I am from the 1980s myself, and her hair makes me feel like I'm at home.
Mm-hmm. I know, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
it,
and,
it
and it changes
wrong if it were a wig.
Again, reality.
When hair is comfort food.
Like she's wearing, like, her hairdo changes from scene to scene. It's fascinating, right? It's like, why she's just got very different hair in the diner. And it's like, okay, I guess that's it. And it is. It's like coming home. It really is. To Leah Thompson's hair. Steve,
you can actually see the hole in the ozone layer hovering above her. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm halfway there with you, Jason. It's a good bad movie until it's a bad movie. I do love the 80s stuff. I had recollections of all that, and all of that stuff was enjoyable. I enjoy how bizarre the tone is and how random it is that we get like the random orgy shop in the middle of this child's movie.
It's a romance spa.
It's Jeffrey Jones store. With his creepy penile tentacle hands, you know, sticking them into the... it's just more of that hoik and cat's magic.
Yeah, there's the title. Creepy penile hands.
But then the last 45 minutes is just chases.
Yes.
And that's it. And none of that involves any of that 80s stuff or any of the goofiness. There's no orgy shops on an ultralight, as it turns out.
Or in a nuclear power plant.
Or in a nuclear power plant.
They just didn't
go
to the right level.
That's true. There's probably something like that in there.
That white room is not where you want to be. You want to be in the dark room.
No, the champagne room.
You want to be in the hot tub fever.
That's right. Or that very, very, very thin mud bath.
The lava of love, I believe, as the neon sign.
That's what it was called.
He was a bad boss, right?
Yeah.
He's really mean to Howard.
Yeah, you generally don't
no
want
reason.
People calling you a creepy little dude at your place of employment.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, no, it just turns unwatchable at that point. And I slept through multiple times. I slept through those 45 minutes and kept having to go back and figure out where I had dropped off. And it was like right at the beginning of the 45 minutes.
It's real bad.
And then the Howard the Duck song, I think, picks it up a little bit, because that's also very 80s.
Well,
but,
it brings it back to the 80s in that moment. But you're right. Like, that's why, again, it's telling that I there are like five different things I can list as the definitive movie killer in this movie. It's got lots of them. You can't just fix one. You know, some movies, it's like, if they fix this, it's like they fix the duck. Nope. But I do think one of the definitive movie killers is that decision to take a quirky comic book and make it a quirky movie about a duck and a girl in a band, and say, what about aliens who fly to Earth on lasers and possess scientists and want to take over the world? And let's build a whole thing out of that. And like, it's so boring. Like, all, I mean, Jeffrey Jones is kind of fun, but like, once it's finally like, let's do chases
It just,
Jason, what if we took Ghostbusters and Streets of Fire, put them in a blender, and then strained out everything interesting about either of those movies or the source material
it's
that this is based
idea.
On?
What if we drop in a guy in a duck suit?
We're out of Ghostbusters. Right. Will you accept Masters of the Universe?
No, okay. No, not the cartoons or toys. Just the live action just, movie.
Yes, Joff Lundgren.
Well, you can sort of understand it because the last thing that this group of people put together, all anybody ever talked about was the theme park ride sequence towards the end of the movie. And that's what we get 45 minutes of here, too. Yeah. So I think they're just trying to relive the mine cart.
Oh, man.
Capture that magic.
Now it's an ultralight.
Whee!
I got to think, you know, I mean, I knew of the comics before the movie came out. And it was only later that I discovered, you know, actually reading them. And I got to think, you know, you go to see this movie as a fan of the comic and go, why did they make this? This is not, I mean, it, again, to take a really obvious joke, it looks like the duck. It talks, well, it doesn't really talk like the duck because he's too nice. It's just puzzling.
Well, and the weird thing is reports say that Steve Gerber was there on the set from time to time throughout the making.
He was not.
He watched a screener of it and said something that endorsed it. And then a few years later, he was like, it's terrible.
He disavowed it. He went to a screening at some point. He signed some paperwork and got a credit and a check.
Yep.
He did not actively involve himself in any part of the filmmaking.
Yeah.
It shows.
And you know what? It's like the beauty of it is that he got to walk away with his dignity intact. That's all you can say about it.
His name was on the movie, but nobody saw the movie, so nobody blamed him for it necessarily.
Right.
I can disagree.
This is what I think of when I think of Howard the Duck is this movie.
It ruined
so bad
property,
to Steve Gerber.
Yeah.
He did not walk away with his dignity at all.
I was trying to be as dry and unfunny as humanly possible.
Well, like the movie.
Like
Gerber, I feel like you're right, Monty, that this just sort of like destroyed the reputation of this thing that he created. At the same time, I do think if you go one level deeper, you will see, but they totally ruined this guy's work that was brilliant. Like that's, but it's level two. You got to go down a level from Howard the Duck is a joke.
I genuinely did not know that the original work was brilliant until I got here tonight and you told me, because I assumed that it was based on a really terrible comic book and that this movie is just all of a piece.
No, the comic's fantastic. And I to put a silver lining on this, when they put Howard the Duck in the post-credits thing for Guardians of the Galaxy. The artist who co-created Howard with Steve Gerber, Val Merrick, lives here in Austin and is a pal of mine. And after there was this revival of interest in the character, after it being associated, to Monty's point, with this movie, which tainted it forevermore, I finally convinced him to see the movie. Steve Gerber had already seen the movie and died and everything, but Val had never seen the movie. We did a screening of it at the Alamo Draft House.
He died a long time after he saw the movie. It wasn't like he died a long time and then died right away.
Yeah, the movie did not
kill Steve Gerber.
But Val Merrick's estimation of the movie upon seeing it for the first time after having not seen it at all, but catching glimpses of it and just being associated with the, oh God, that stupid duck movie. His one reaction was, well, that Leah Thompson, she sure is charismatic.
Yeah. See?
And that was it. That's all he had.
That's really all you can take from it.
Yeah.
Or not.
And also, Thomas Dolby, not going to make it on the Greatest Hits album.
He blinded me with science fiction.
Yeah. And George Clinton, too. Yeah. That's it. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. It's a duck.
Happy Thanksgiving. We're sorry.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. That you aren't watching this movie right now.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Instead, you're listening to a podcast about it. Let me thank my dinner guests. We're going to have some of Moises's hot, crispy Brussels sprouts as a side dish again, but that's a different podcast. Buddy Ashley, thanks for being here.
I'm glad I was here.
I am glad you were too. Even though we disagree a little bit on Leah Thompson, it's okay. I get what you're saying. I do. Erica Ensign.
Please report Howard the Duck is not on Thomas Dolby's Greatest Hits album.
It is not. Oh, no, it's not. Monty, I have Thomas Dolby's Greatest Hits album. I like Thomas Dolby. I had never heard any of these songs other than...
You had forgotten that he was all over this movie, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely.
He's actually in it too. He's the bartender where the bar fight happens.
Thanks, Erica.
Yeah, my grandma actually did used to serve duck for Thanksgiving sometimes, so I feel this is appropriate. We've served it up.
It's a Rocket Surgery banquet. Moises Chuyon, thank you.
You know, I figured out what the movie did lack. It was either an adventure into fear or a giant sized man thing.
One of those. Steve Lutz, thank you.
Thank you, Jason. As I pull my chair up to the table and prepare my cutlery, I can only say one thing. I'm going to get you, you dumb duck.
David J. Lohr, thank you.
Thank you. And I have a quote from the film to end with.
Great.
But I can also, I also use it to pay homage to Steve. Eat beak, Snell.
Okay, thank you. And Annette Weirstra, thank you.
Thank you for coming. I have brought a homemade apple pie with ice cream so we can all eat that and forget about the experience of watching this movie.
We'll tuck in. Yeah, that's it. And thanks to everybody out there for watching. You know, I had this dream the other day. I was running my fingers through your feathers and then, well, come over and I'll tell you what happened next. We'll see you next time.